Just remember, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening.
Is cruising a lost art? There might be several answers to this question. According to Alex Espinoza, the author of the book Cruising, An Intimate History of a Radical Pastime.
Walt Whitman, the father of modern American literature, was one of the first modern writers to incorporate homosexual desire into his poetry.
Most trans people go through a point, sometimes lasting years or even forever, when different strangers will perceive them as different genders. Sometimes there is no right bathroom for us.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Brazil's top court makes anti-queer bias a crime. A guided tour takes us through the culture of cruising, and a trans teen faces toilet trauma. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Brian DeShazer.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending May 25, 2019. Brazil's Supreme Federal Tribunal has voted to outlaw homophobic and transphobic discrimination in the same way that current laws ban racism. Six justices of the 11-member High Court issued their decision on May 23rd. The remaining five justices are scheduled to vote on June 5th. But it's now only a formality, since the other six have already unanimously ruled to make anti-queer bias in Brazil a criminal offense. The High Court ruling will take effect after the June 5th vote. Justice Louise Fuchs told reporters that racism is a crime against flesh and blood, whether it is a member of the LGBT community, a Jew, or an Afro-descendant. Equality activists welcomed the ruling, especially since the country's new president, Jair Bolsonaro, who took office on January 1st, has made obnoxiously anti-queer comments, calling himself a proud homophobe, and saying that he'd rather have a dead son than a gay son. He's also denigrated blacks and other minorities. Even though marriage equality has been the law of the land in heavily Roman Catholic Brazil since 2013, the country's large evangelical movement has pushed back against further progress, and deep-seated societal prejudices can still make it dangerous to be openly queer in the country. According to one of Brazil's oldest rights groups, Grupo Gay de Bahia, more than 420 LGBTQ people were killed across Brazil in 2018, and the group has already counted at least 141 murders so far this year. Racism was criminalized in Brazil in 1989, punishing violators with up to 5 years in prison. The High Court ruling puts homophobia and transphobia on par with racism until Congress approves specific legislation to protect LGBTQ people. Brazil's Senate is currently considering a bill to ban discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity or expression with the same 5-year prison term. President Bolsonaro had yet to respond to the ruling when we recorded this newscast.
But a 3-judge panel of Kenya's High Court voted unanimously on May 24th to maintain the East African country's criminal laws against consensual adult same-gender sex. The nation's penal code, a gift from the British Empire in 1930, punishes carnal knowledge of any person against the order of nature and gross indecency with up to 21 years in prison. The three justices decided that those laws are not discriminatory. They rejected arguments that Kenya's constitution guarantees that the state shall not discriminate directly or indirectly against any person on any ground. The judges also decided that anti-queer laws don't discourage people from seeking HIV/AIDS testing and treatment, as the petitioners had also argued. Attorneys who spoke in favor of maintaining the status quo focused primarily on religion, parroting the usual false claims that LGBTQ people threaten the nuclear family structure and that same-gender attraction is un-African. Eric Gitari, co-founder of Kenya's National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission and one of the petitioners in the case, called it a sad day for the rule of law and human rights. He said he and the other petitioners would challenge the decision in the Court of Appeal.
Tunisia's Court of Appeal ruled on May 20th that the LGBTQ rights group Shams has the legal right to exist and continue its advocacy for LGBTQ rights, upholding a 2016 lower court ruling. This was reportedly the government's seventh attempt to shut down the group. Tunisian officials have pointed to the North African nation's Penal Code Article 230, which punishes consensual adult same-gender sex with a three-year prison term. The activities of this association are contrary to the principles of Muslim society, the government claimed, and Islam prohibits these practices. Shams president, Munir Batur, applauded the appeals court decision. He told The Guardian that the judicial harassment against our association reflects the homophobia of the Tunisian state and its will to discriminate and stigmatize the LGBT community, which is already marginalized. He said his group has tracked an escalating number of arrests under the Penal Code's anti-queer sex provisions in the past few years. It's already counted more than 25 convictions in the first quarter of 2019.
But hundreds of gay and lesbian couples began marrying in Taiwan on May 24th as the law giving them that right took effect. Couples were lined up outside government offices at 8:30 in the morning on the 24th in the capital city, Taipei. After a brief registration process, each couple walked out legally wed as onlookers cheered and applauded. That scene was duplicated in cities and towns across the island. The Ministry of the Interior said that as of 2 p.m. on the first day, it had registered 247 lesbian and 116 gay male couples. Taiwan's Constitutional Court ruled on May 24, 2017, that denying civil marriage to same-gender couples was unconstitutional. It ordered members of the legislative yuan to enact a marriage equality bill within 2 years. Voters in a national referendum in November 2018 rejected marriage equality by an almost 70% margin. But lawmakers passed a government-backed measure on May 17th that's almost equal to the rights given to heterosexual couples. Issues around adoption and transnational marriages are still to be worked out. Celebrated Taiwanese activist Chai Chiu-wei was the first person to come out as a gay man in Taiwan in 1986. He's been calling on the government to establish marriage equality for almost 30 years. He happily served as a witness for some of the couples during their wedding ceremonies. He urged activists throughout Asia to also take their battles for equality to court.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development told operators of federally funded homeless shelters this week that it's virtually okay to discriminate against transgender people. It's the latest move by the Trump administration to roll back advances in equality made during the Obama era. The new guidelines, published on May 22nd, allow shelter operators to cite religious belief or other factors in choosing the specific accommodations they offer based on a person's gender or gender identity. It allows shelters to force trans people into housing based on their birth gender rather than gender identity. That can literally be life-threatening for trans women if their only alternative is to be housed with cisgender men. Mara Keisling of the National Center for Transgender Equality called the proposed policy changes a heartless attack on some of the most vulnerable people in our society. The new rules are subject to a public comment period before taking effect. According to the National Coalition for the Homeless, 30% of people using housing programs in the U.S. identify as LGBTQ.
A coalition of almost two dozen U.S. states and cities has already filed suit against the Trump administration over its new rules allowing healthcare providers to refuse to provide or pay for medical services to LGBTQ people if doing so violates their religious or moral beliefs. And this week, Trump's Department of Health and Human Services published a memo that proposes eliminating gender identity as one of the factors that the government considers in crafting healthcare policy. It would specifically overturn provisions of Barack Obama's 2016 Affordable Care Act that incorporate gender identity into bans on bias on the basis of sex. A department statement said that the new policy would allow words to be narrowly used in their plain meaning when they were written, instead of attempting to redefine sex discrimination to include gender identity. Chris Hayashi of the Transgender Law Center warned that the new policy puts the lives of transgender people in jeopardy, particularly trans people living with HIV, black transgender people, and people of color, trans people with disabilities, and rural and southern trans folks. This new policy is also going through a 60-day public comment period. If the moves by the housing and health departments go into effect, they're sure to be met by legal challenges. And in a demonstration of more than gall, the Trump administration kicked off the upcoming traditional June Pride Month online by offering rainbow-themed LGBTQ for Trump t-shirts. Unlike his predecessor, who held celebratory pride events in the White House during each year of his administration, Trump has yet to issue so much as a pride proclamation.
And finally, the person named India's fastest woman, sprinter Duti Chand, has become the country's first openly queer athlete. She told an English language daily earlier in the week that she was dating a woman from her village in eastern Odisha state. She said in a follow-up interview that she intends to fight for marriage equality. Chand said that the September 2018 ruling by India's Supreme Court that finally overturned the country's colonial-era anti-queer sex laws gave her the courage to come out. "I have found someone who is my soulmate," she told the Sunday Express. "I believe everyone should have the freedom to be with whomever they decide they want to be with." Chand won 2 silver medals at the Asian Games last year. She said her current focus is on upcoming international competitions, including the Olympics. Chand said she wants to keep the name of her soulmate out of the limelight so that the relationship does not become the center of attention. "But in the future," she said, "I would like to settle down with her."
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending May 25th, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazor, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more.
And now you can listen to NewsWrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out radio YouTube channel. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Brian DeShazor.
The full stats are in for the first day of marriage equality in Taiwan. More than 500 same-gender couples tied the knot on May 24th. 341 female couples and 185 male couples took their vows in the first legal marriages of same-gender couples in Asia. Who's next?
The fear of trans people being dangerous or predatory in bathrooms is completely unfounded. In fact, more Republican lawmakers have been arrested for sexual misconduct in public bathrooms than trans people have.
Turmoil in the toilet, later in the program. Get on board this love boat for another kind of cruise. This Way Out queer life and lit commentator Janet Mason explains.
Is cruising a lost art? There might be several answers to this question, according to Alex Espinoza, the author of the book Cruising, An Intimate History of a Radical Pastime, a book about the experiences of gay men. I learned a lot. The first thing was I learned that cruising can have a cultural context. On reflection, I realized that this shouldn't have been a surprise. Everything has a cultural context. Growing up as a Mexican American, Espinoza's first memories of cruising were of his brothers and their friends dressing up to go out to pick up girls. As the author writes, it's hard to trace exactly how the term became associated with anonymous sexual encounters in the gay community. People cruised in their cars, my brothers and their friends, quote, cruised for chicks. All of these involved, to some degree or another, the act of leisurely crossing and recrossing the same place. They involved the acts of seeing and being seen, of pursuing and being pursued. Yet no one knows exactly when or how the phrase became synonymous with secret sexual encounters. We know the word has its origin in the Latin word crux, or cross. I learned about the history of the gay bar in places called Molly Houses in London in the 1700s, where men would meet, as Espinoza writes, to stage drag shows, mingle, and have sex. It was, of course, at the time, a crime. Many were arrested. In one raid in 1726 in Mother Claps, London's most infamous Molly House at the time, 40 men were arrested. More than a few gay men resisted arrest. Resistance that might have been overcome at the time, but which portended changes to come. As he travels through history, Espinosa writes about the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s and how it devastated the gay community and subsequently changed the behavior of many gay men. He writes that the massive losses of the time caused many gay men to turn to long-term monogamous commitments. He also writes of the history of online chat rooms and the gay hookup apps of today. Espinosa writes that an argument can be made that because of its ability to pre-screen and its exclusionary practice, using apps like Grindr does not qualify as cruising. He also writes about the drawbacks of using popular gay hookup apps in repressive countries. While such apps have helped people connect, they have also become tools for authorities. In countries like Russia and Uganda, the latter known as the most dangerous place in the world to be gay, the act of modern-day cruising with its digital paper trail can be a death sentence. But Espinosa also writes that the act of cruising is eternal. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Hello, I'm Robbie Kaplan, the author of Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. And you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
May 31st marks the 200th anniversary of the birth of one of the world's most acclaimed poets and one of the gayest. We've woven a couple of rainbow minutes together to say happy birthday.
Walt Whitman, the father of modern American literature, was one of the first modern writers to incorporate homosexual desire into his poetry. But afraid to explicitly assert his own homosexuality, he substituted the vague phrase, the love of comrades. He was even secretive in his own journals to hide the identity and gender of a significant person in his life. It's clear from his manuscripts in the Library of Congress that the pronoun him was erased and her written over it. In addition, a name was written as 164, a simple numerical disguise. The 16th letter of the alphabet is P, the fourth is D, revealing the name Peter Doyle.
In 1865, poet Walt Whitman found himself in uncharacteristically high spirits. He had recently formed a long-term attachment. It all began on a cold winter night. With a blanket around his shoulders, he stepped aboard a horse car bound for his home in Washington, D.C. The red-haired conductor was a man named Peter Doyle. Doyle later described that special night, saying, "It was a lonely night, so I thought I would go in and talk with him. Something in me made me do it, and something in him drew me that way. He used to say there was something in me that had the same effect on him. Anyway, I went into the car. We were familiar at once. I put my hand on his knee. We both understood."
Whitman and Doyle, in fact, shared a significant relationship for over 20 years, and in 1873, Doyle lived with Whitman and attended to him daily while the poet was recovering from a stroke. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns
and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Alan Brown.
And me, Mike Kinerman.
Hey everybody, this is Leah Delaria, and you are listening to This Way Out.
Step to the left, now step to the right. Put your knees together and squeeze them tight. Keep your arms moving side to side. Try to hold it in till it's time to ride. Knock, knock, let me in. Knock, knock, let me in. I gotta go. Knock, knock, let me in. Knock, knock, let me in. I gotta go.
They may be rejected by the military, but young trans people are being drafted to fight the battle of the bathroom. The Outcasting Overtime crew has something to say about that.
This is Outcasting Overtime from Media for the Public Good, producer of Public Radio's LGBTQ youth programs. Hi, I'm Dhruv, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Andrew talks about his experience using public bathrooms as a trans person and the effect that policing of bathrooms has on the trans community as a whole.
For most people, there's nothing particularly stressful about using public bathrooms. You go in, do your business, and get out. You've probably never questioned which bathroom you're supposed to use, or whether it's safe for you to do so. But for me, and for other transgender people, it's a lot more complicated than that. Before coming out, I spent most of my life using the women's bathroom. I never had any problems with this until I cut my hair short a couple of years before coming out. From that point on, an increasing number of strangers who saw me would read me as male. Not long after cutting my hair, I remember an incident when I walked into a public bathroom right behind a woman. She was sort of handing off the door to me, since I was walking in right behind her, but when she saw me, she turned around and said, "This is the women's bathroom," clearly implying that I didn't belong there. I was taken aback, humiliated, and unsure of how to handle the situation. I just said, "Excuse me," as if I didn't know what she was talking about, and after a few moments of looking at me suspiciously, she continued into the bathroom. Going forward, it wasn't so common for people to directly confront me in the bathroom, but it was common for people to give me suspicious looks, and I was always afraid of being confronted again. There wasn't much I could do about the situation. I knew that I didn't belong in the women's bathroom, and clearly many of the strangers I encountered thought the same. But before I was out, using the men's bathroom was out of the question, especially if I was with or might be seen by anyone I knew. I would use gender-neutral bathrooms whenever there were any, but I often just ended up doing whatever I could to avoid using public bathrooms. Although, of course, that wasn't always possible. For trans people, particularly those who aren't fully out or can't reliably predict how strangers will perceive them, deciding what bathroom to use can be stressful and complicated. We mean well and don't want to face any confrontation in public bathrooms, so we usually just want to use whatever public bathroom we're least likely to attract attention in. However, that isn't always predictable or possible. I'm lucky enough that strangers almost always perceive me as male, so I've never had any problems using the men's bathroom. However, not every trans person has that privilege. Most trans people go through a point, sometimes lasting years or even forever, when different strangers will perceive them as different genders. This can make it almost impossible to guarantee that everyone around you thinks you're using the right public bathroom. Sometimes there is no right bathroom for us. For example, using the bathroom was particularly uncomfortable at the research lab I was working at last summer. At that point, I was out to some people, and I might have used the men's bathroom in some situations, depending upon who I was with. However, I wasn't out to the people at my lab, so they considered me female. I was afraid to use the men's bathroom, in case someone from my lab saw me. I spent the whole day at the lab, so it was inevitable that I needed to use the bathrooms there regularly. So I had no choice but to use the women's bathroom. Not only did this make me uncomfortable, it also made other people uncomfortable. I remember incidents where I would be washing my hands, and I'd see someone open the bathroom door to walk in, see me, look up at the bathroom sign, look back at me, and turn around and walk away, apparently too disturbed by or suspicious of my presence to use the same bathroom as me. I just had to pee, and the women's bathroom felt like the only option in that situation, but incidents like this made it shameful and stressful. Even now that I use the men's bathroom without issue, I still can't quite shake the general anxiety I get about using public bathrooms, nor the habit of avoiding them. I know that I'm unlikely to face any confrontation in public bathrooms anymore. In addition to the fact that nearly all strangers perceive me as male, people using the men's bathroom tend to face a lot less scrutiny than people using the women's bathroom. This is because women tend to be more concerned about predatory men than men are about predatory women, with good reason. The 2015 U.S. Transgender Survey of trans people across the United States found that, like me, 59% of trans people have avoided public bathrooms in the past year out of fear of confrontation. Keep in mind that this whole survey only asked about occurrences from a single year, not from the people's entire lifetimes. Trans people aren't just avoiding bathrooms out of paranoia. 24% recalled being told they were in the wrong bathroom. 12% had been attacked, harassed, or sexually assaulted in a bathroom. And 9% had been denied access to the right bathroom. And avoiding bathrooms affects trans people's health. The survey found that 31% of trans people avoided eating or drinking in order to avoid needing to use the bathroom, and 8% of trans people reported having a kidney or urinary tract infection as a result of avoiding bathrooms. Again, all of this is just from the year preceding the survey. This survey was in 2015, but things haven't gotten better since then. In 2016, North Carolina passed a law requiring that trans people, when they were in many public buildings, use the bathrooms corresponding with the sex listed on their birth certificate. The law was quickly repealed after nationwide boycotts put massive economic pressure on North Carolina. But it pulled trans people and our bathroom rights further into the national political conversation, causing complaints, particularly on the right, about trans people being allowed to choose which bathrooms they use. These complaints usually involve concerns about allowing men in women's bathrooms, but keep in mind that the North Carolina bill would have forced me to use the women's bathroom, the very place where I have made a lot of women very uncomfortable in the past, and where most women who see me would agree that I don't belong. In addition, the fear of trans people being dangerous or predatory in bathrooms is completely unfounded. In fact, more Republican lawmakers have been arrested for sexual misconduct in public bathrooms than trans people have. That's 3 Republican lawmakers, and according to multiple reports, 0 trans people. The best policy towards trans people in public bathrooms is to respect our ability to judge which bathroom is safest and best for us and those around us. Whenever possible, we want to use the bathroom in which we're least likely to draw attention to ourselves, which is by definition also the one where we're least likely to make others uncomfortable. Forcing us to use any particular bathroom, or trying to tell us which bathroom you think we belong in, is counterproductive to that goal. We are the experts in our own situations and lives, and we know what option is best for us. Often, though, the options aren't great. Gender-segregated bathrooms force tough decisions and uncomfortable or even unsafe situations on many trans people, both binary and non-binary. For the sake of our safety, dignity, and state of mind, it's important to stop politicizing our bathroom choices. Many people who have never met a trans person might say that, as a trans male, I belong in the women's bathroom. But I can assure you that many of the women I've encountered in women's bathrooms would disagree.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, which produces public radio's LGBTQ youth programs. Our executive producer is Mark Sofus. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from John Dye V and Brian DeShazer, produced with Brian DeShazer, from Janet Mason, Alan Brown and Mike Heinerman, produced by Jed Proctor and Brian Burns, and from Outcasters Andrew and Drew, produced by Mark Sofus. The Village People and Teen Titans performed some of the music you heard, with a tip of the This Way Out hat to J.D. Doyle, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trenton, Paul Bannon, Richard Merck, and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WFCS New Britain, Connecticut, South Ribble Community Radio, Lancashire, England, 2BLU Katoomba, New South Wales, and some 200 stations and other outlets around the world, including this one. Stay tuned.